Hello, welcome to Late to It. I'm Naomi Frisby.
I'm Kirsty Doe.
And this is a podcast about reading books at the right time. Kirsty, what have you been reading on time this week?
So, as we discussed last time, we've both been going through quite the reading slump recently, and that does continue somewhat, although the improvement is being made, but it's I'm still not sort of back to normal, as it were. So, sort of between reading for the podcast, obviously, and also I do a lot of reading for work, which I've been doing. So in between that, I kind of needed something really easy to read. And so I went back to my horror genre comfort zone, and I read a book called Ghostwritten by Ronald Malfi, which is published in this country by Titan, who publishes a lot of horror and sci-fi and fantasy and stuff like that, although that's not my area, but they do quite a lot of horror. And it was published for the first time in the UK in October 2022. This is four interlinked novellas, all of which are to do with haunted books, haunted stories. So the first one is about a novel that does not want to be adapted. So it's not the physical book that is sort of haunted or possessed, it's the story within it. And any attempt that's made to alter it, or in this particular case, in this novella, adapt it for the screen, the story gets angry and the story takes revenge. The story eats things. Cats.
Oh, well, did I confess last time that I don't like cats, so it can eat all the cats it wants? Sorry, cat lovers.
my cat is in the room just behind me.
It's all right, we're in separate rooms, so I can't eat it from you.
there's another story where these two brothers, who are kind of small-time criminals, basically, drug runners, they're basically errand boys for the underworld, as it were, have to make this delivery of a very special book, which they think is rather bizarre and hilarious, but the book has quite a lot about it, and when one of them ignores the very strict rules not to touch the book, bad things happen. There's an incredibly creepy scene in it, actually, where they end up, they're driving, they've got to take this very specific route to the drop-off point in America. And they're going, they need to get food or something like that. And they pull into this very small town that is not on any map. And it's really, really bizarre place. Like, they pull into a kind of gas station, convenience store place, and there is no one, there are no people, but the shop is fully lit, fully stocked. But all the brands are slightly wrong. So they all look right, but the brand names are slightly different. And it's just, everything's very off kilter. And for all that is, you know, quite a kind of schlocky horror novel, you know, series of interlinked novellas or whatever, actually there are some really creepy scenes in it. And that one with the sort of deserted but fully brightly lit town is definitely one of them. The third novella, this book belongs to Olo, my favourite horror subgenre, the demon child, who controls this pop-up book where people, it sort of represents his house. And if there's people in his house, he can sort of manipulate the pop-up book so the house changes and people get locked in weird dimensions and stuff. And then the fourth one is what I thought was the weakest one, actually, is it's a choose your own adventure story that starts spilling into real life. So it's all kind of, you know, yes, there are some quite cheesy bits in it, but if you like horror, if you like supernatural horror particularly, then this is, I do recommend it. I really did enjoy it. Like, is it the greatest work of literature, you know, the craft of writing that I've ever seen? No, but did I thoroughly enjoy it? I did thoroughly enjoy it. So, horror fans, Ghostwritten by Ronald Malfi is definitely, I mean, it's got Ghostwritten. It's about haunted books. Come on. I mean, it's just perfect. What else could you call it?
It definitely sounds entertaining.
It's very entertaining. Very entertaining. What about you? What have you been reading?
Something much darker.
darker than a, you know, possessed child in possession of a pop-up.
Yes, because although this says it's fiction, it is based on real life. So this is Pick the Latch by Catherine Scanlon, which at the beginning of the year was all over my social media. So it's published by Dark Books. Catherine Scanlon, I think is slightly better known in America than here, but I still think she's a bit of a cult writer. I know that since this has come out, they're bringing out one of her earlier books over here as well. My timeline was very excited about all of this. So what Scanlon's done is she has transcribed a load of interviews with a woman called Sonia, who is a horse trainer, and this captures her life. It says here, I'm just going to read what it says in part of the blurb, which I never do, but it says, as Scanlon puts it, I wanted to preserve, amplify, exaggerate Sonia's idiosyncratic speech, her bluntness, her flair as a storyteller. I arrived at what you could call a composite portrait of herself. And what she's done is taken these interviews. I mean, she calls it fiction because she's put this structure on it. So she's put it in the order that she wants it. It's sort of chronological. But obviously she's chosen the order, she's chosen the anecdotes she's going to include, she's created an arc out of it. It's really, really brilliant, and it's to do with the way that she's captured Sonia's voice, it's to do with the precision of the writing, it's really short chapters. I'm going to read one in a second, a very short one, to give you like a taste, but I just found it, well, it's superb. And I think one of the reasons that people have gone mad for it is because there is so little writing about working class people and working class people's voices.
Mm.
And so a little bit of me is a bit like, the celebrated middle class person, I assume, doing this rather than Sonia telling her own story, which she never suggests she wants to do. But still, I have got a bit of a like scowl for the publishing industry in terms of, like, you know, where this is coming from. However, it is really, really good. So it's a chapter called Milk Bones from near the beginning. The neighbour girl who was my age, Regina, we lived on dog biscuits, milk bones. We ate slices of bread from the bag. No one was there in the morning when I got ready for school. I put on my mum's red lipstick and her dresses and her high-heeled shoes. In first grade, 8 girls had me up against the locker saying, puncher, puncher. I didn't want to fight, but when one of them came at me, I kicked off my heels and let her have it. They took us to the principal's office and later my mum showed up. There were scratches on the girl's face and she had a black eye. I thought they would put me in prison. My mum said, are those my shoes? And like, there are bits of it that are really funny, but also there are bits of it that are like so grim. There's this brilliant story that she tells about this woman who basically lives in a hole.
Mm.
And at the time I was reading it, I was still with my boyfriend because I read it out to him and he's going, is this real? And I'm like, yes, it's real. It's really, really fascinating and really brilliantly constructed.
Mm.
Yeah, totally recommend.
Yeah, I mean, it was all over my, well, our feeds are probably quite similar to be fair, but it was all over my feeds as well. And I do have a copy, which is very kindly given to me by publicist at Daunt, who I know. And I have to say, on first glance, I was put off by horse. I think, you know, obviously Kick the Latch, there's a horse on the front cover. I am not a horsey gal. I have never been one of those, you know, I've nothing against them, but I have no strong feelings about horses in the way that some people obviously like really keen on horses. So at first I was a bit like, do I want to read a book about horses though? It's like, you know, would you want to read a book about cats?
I mean, I'm not interested in horses either. And I bought it just because people were talking about like how brilliant it was. And I got a bit of a sense of what she was trying to do. It's not really about horses. I mean, it talks about her life at the track.
And yes.
Like she has a horse that she loves and there's quite a kind of poignant moment with that. But it's not, it's about her life. It's about her as a person.
Yeah, so, you know, now that I've got a copy of it and actually have probably looked at it and again heard you talk about it, it's like, yes, I do want to make time to get to it. I'm not saying it'll be this year, but I do want to read it and I will read it eventually. So we have got onto the books that we're talking about this week. We have two books about the land, about climate, about landscape, about the places in which we live and the world in which we live in. One fiction, one non-fiction. We're going to be starting with the non-fiction, which is Under the Rock by Benjamin Myers. Now, as we alluded to at the end of the last episode, this has a different subtitle depending on whether you've got the hardback or the paperback. I had the hardback out the library, and it was The Poetry of a Place, but you've got the paperback, haven't you? What have you got?
I have, and it is Stories Carved from the Land, which I prefer, I think.
I prefer. I think they made a good choice when they came to reposition for paperback. This is a book that is about Benjamin Myers kind of investigate. Whenever I go to describe this, I never feel like I get it quite right. It's about Scout Rock. And it's a rock that sort of overlooks where he lives. It's a rock that has been written about lots, you know, by lots of people. It is a place that, you know, Ted Hughes notably comes up a lot in the book, wrote about or was inspired by. It's not a history of Scout Rock. It's not necessarily a history even of its influence on literature. It's sort of just how that particular landscape has impacted the lives of the people around it, I guess. Would you say?
Yeah, I think so. It felt to me a bit like he was keeping a journal of things that he was doing when he moved there. And like, yeah, he goes out and walks nearly the same walk like every day by the looks of it, and so this that sort of repetitiveness of living in that landscape and the changes that happen there.
Yeah, but obviously it's in Yorkshire, and that's actually where you're from, although different part of Yorkshire, right? So you've probably got stronger feelings about how it writes about Yorkshire, you know, talks about Yorkshire, than I do, who is only been to where my dad has now lived for like the last 2 years.
Yeah, and like Yorkshire's massive, so where your dad lives is miles away from where Ben's writing about, and miles away from where I live. I called him Ben then, I apologize, I have met him.
Like Mr. Myers.
Yes, Mr. Myers, Mrs. Stripe, or Ms. Stripe. Yeah, that was because he's married to Adele Stripe, who he mentions quite a lot in the book. Anyway, yeah, so I know that landscape quite well because I used to live in Home Firth, which is West Yorkshire, and also the town that I grew up in. So the town I grew up in is outside Barnsley. I always say that I'm from Barnsley. Somebody picked me up on this the other week in the most hilarious manner, because even Penistone's not Barnsley. And I went, yeah, it is. It's like, it's its nearest town. It's the postcode it's the postal districts it comes under. It's the council it comes under. It's the telephone number it comes under. And he went, everybody I've ever met from Penistone always says they're from Penistone. They're very like clear about it. And I went, that's because they're all snobs. However, Penistone's right on the border between South Yorkshire and West Yorkshire. Home Firth's a bit further into West Yorkshire. Ben Myers is writing about further into West Yorkshire, like towards the Manchester side. But like Yorkshire's massive. So
yeah.
But I do know the landscape that he's talking about. I've been there quite a lot. And I think at one point he does talk about Hebden Bridge and how it's full of like writers and stuff, like it's become sort of a bit of an enclave for people. And it's also where Happy Valley was filmed, which like everybody except you probably was watching at the beginning of the year.
I feel positively towards it without having watched an episode at all. People I like seem to like it, and that's good enough for me.
It's very good. Anyway, yes, so I do like feel like I've got some sort of connection towards this, and it makes, I suppose it makes it more interesting. I mean, Barnsley gets mentioned at one point, and the Peak District, which is, you know, just down the road from where I live now. Yeah, so I did feel like, I don't know, fondly excited, interested towards it. I'm also a massive fan of Benjamin Myers' work generally anyway. I've read loads of his books, so yeah.
Yeah, this is the first thing I've read by him, actually. I don't really know why. I do actually own a couple of his books, a couple of his novels that I've, like so many things, not got around to actually reading. So I sort of came into this with having no expectations about, him or the writing, because actually I didn't really know anything about him other than he was from, I think he's from the Northeast, isn't he, and now lives in Yorkshire and has written novels. That's sort of my sum total of Benjamin Myers knowledge. So I had, you know, I was kind of going in a blank slate, really. But I loved it. And I think what I liked about it was the way he writes about the place, but also the way he writes about the people that are in the place. You know, he talks about our postman Alan, a Marxist and misanthrope with a PhD in horror films. He is officially a doctor of horror and a love of contemporary Norwegian jazz. I love Alan.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the people. They feel to me, I mean, I don't know what it's like in other places. I'm sure there are other, like, you know, towns and whatever that are like this, but it very much felt like, yeah, they're exactly the sort of people you meet. Yeah, no, plenty of them. That sort of thing. So, yeah, I did enjoy the people that he bumps into.
Yeah. Now, I'm slightly winging it because I had to give my copy back to the library before we recorded this episode, so I've got some very hastily scrawled notes. So I don't know if you want to launch off and I'll catch up.
Well, for me, I thought there were loads of things that were really interesting that he had to say about, I don't know, I guess the countryside and what it's like. Like, he's talking about now and sort of contemporary issues of being there. So, I mean, really early on, he talks about as being post-rural now, because only 7% of people live in rural communities, which is kind of fascinating when we had this pandemic thing, when it's like outside and back to nature. And you remember right at the beginning, they were telling people to stay out of, you know, the Lake District and the Peak District, and because people were going out walking, and how very dare we, like... Yeah. And it's one of the things I come back to this so often, because I walk in the Peak District. It's like I said, it's just down the roads. But like Sarah Moss writing about it in the Fell, when I interviewed her, she was talking about how outrageous it was that we weren't allowed to like go for a bloody walk in the fresh air outside. Mm. How dare we, etc. But you know, one of the things he's talking about is that thing where we've sort of become disconnected from it, and people are like, it's a place to go, and I don't know, hang out or be with nature or whatever. There was a bit where I thought was really interesting. He's talking about Samuel Johnson's famous quote about when someone's tired of London, the tide of life, and Ben counteracts that with, the man who fears the countryside fears himself. And I've been thinking about that the whole time, because one of the things about being out there, I mean, he talks about, he walks in a place that's not popular. He walks in a place where actually there's no path, and he finds his own path through. And there is that thing about when you're out there, like, I don't know, sometimes it's just you and the birds and whatever wildlife's about. And I don't find that scary, but there's nothing to distract you. That's what you're looking for. It's you and your head is out. One of the things that really made me laugh, and this is quite personal, but I'm going to read it, because like I said, I go out walking quite a bit. But what I've discovered, I'm writing about this at the minute, but what I've discovered is, if I go out walking with someone else, I tend to fall over. I don't know why, like, I haven't got an answer for why this is. I've got some thoughts about maybe why. When I'm on my own, it doesn't tend to happen. Ben says this: my infatuation with the dense woods on the doorstep grows as I spend more and more time in this private paradise. Despite its reputation, it is a place of calm and daily escape, and I begin to tramp new paths through the undergrowth. I fall over perhaps once a week on Scout Rock, often more in the wet months. I slip rather than trip, in the greasy soil or from rocks whose gleaming surfaces are as slick as engine oil. Down holes unseen, I crash through dead bracken, fall onto moss mattresses, slide through shits of unknown origin. There I go, snatching at tussocks and roots, slipping, then standing to see the brown streaks that coat me from toe to head, the dog looking on quizzically. And I'm like, oh, it's not just me. Hurrah. Because I do that. If I'm with somebody, they always go, are you all right? Have you hurt yourself? But I always slip, so like, without realising, so I don't tense up and I don't tend to fall in a weird way. I just slide. Like.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that entertained me because, yeah. I had some sympathy with that. Do you want me to just keep going? Other things, horrendous things, asbestos scandal that I did not know about.
No, I didn't know about it either.
So I wanted to talk about this because I thought this was really important, that this is the first time I've ever seen this, and I don't live that far from Calderdale, and certainly didn't when I lived in Home Firth. So yeah, so there was a massive asbestos scandal where there was a place called Acre Mill, and when they didn't dispose of the asbestos, obviously then what they did was they took it and dumped it at Heptonstall, at Peckett Well, Mountainskip, and at Scout Rock. And so yeah, there it was, sitting there for years until it started to poison everybody, because yeah.
There's a bit where it says that was one of the things I noted down was in that chapter where, let me find it. In 1978, it was briefly considered by the local council whether to make the asbestos tip in the heart of Scout Rock, whether the asbestos tip in the heart of Scout Rock might make a good picnic site.
Yeah, and I mean they've had to pay out millions.
Yeah, I had no idea about any of that. I mean, asbestos, by the time I was sort of aware of what asbestos was, it was only ever in the context of this kind of horrible poisonous thing that I remember my school having to get like whole parts of my school were like closed off with plastic while they did all the kind of asbestos removal and all that sort of stuff. So, to read about how really not long before that, it was sort of, yeah, let's put a picnic site on a top of a place we've dumped a load of asbestos, sure.
The very start of that section, I'm just going to read it because I think it's really important. He says, "The Calderdale asbestos scandal is now widely recognised as the worst ever industrial accident in Britain, worse than any explosion, landslide, building collapse, or mining disaster. Yet because it was not a single time-specific event, it is less newsworthy."
Yeah, that reminds me of an essay I read. It's actually a book that I worked on, called The Unreality of Memory, that was published a couple of years ago. I think I sent you it.
Eliza Gabbett.
Yes, brilliant collection of essays. And in the first, I think it's the first essay in the collection, she talks about the spectacle of disaster. We can, remember where we were when the Twin Towers collapsed, when Grenfell happened, when we end up having these conversations of what's the first big disaster, the kind of slightly macabre thing of what's the first big disaster you remember, or where were you when you heard about Princess Diana? That's not, that's not a disaster in this, well, disaster for her. You know what I mean, like that sort of these big kind of traumatic events. But something like this that actually has a far greater impact for a far greater number of people for over a far greater length of time, because it hasn't got the splashy headline. It isn't a rocket exploding on takeoff. It isn't a huge terrorist attack. It can very easily slip under the radar.
Well, I think that fits as well with like one of the things that obviously underpins this, and I think you mentioned at the beginning, was thinking about climate change. And there's quite a chunk of the book where he's talking about the floods that happened in Hebden Bridge. So I can't remember when this was now. I'm gonna look. Not that long ago. And it always feels like it's imminent again. I'm not sure. I know it was before the pandemic, but not that far before. Yeah. So basically the water starts creeping up, and then oh, there's a really interesting bit about how storms are named. Anyway, yeah, so it gets really bad, and then and there's a point in the where they think their house is gonna, well, they're supposed to evacuate and they don't, they stay where they are. But Hebden Bridge is flooded because it's down at the bottom of the valley. And there's stuff that I thought was, I mean, it's horrendous. And if you saw the pictures and stuff at the time, then you know it was grim. And you can look from the all over the internet. But there's a bit where so they start this rescue operation and they're all out trying to help people. And there's flats where old people live, so they're trying to rescue them. And there's a guy there. Yeah, and they tried to get him out. And he says, where is it? "Submerged garden gates, barriers, bins, and other obstacles make swimming too risky. So I wade across the forecourt and into a flat where a large man is sitting in a wheelchair, almost entirely underwater. On the windowsill nearby, he has managed to place his TV control, an old pay-as-you-go phone, and glasses. Morning, he says. And like there's people who like they struggle to get people out because they don't want to leave their homes. Like, I totally understand that. Did make me laugh. So the Upper Calder Valley has such a rich history of flooding that its continued habitation is testament to little other than Yorkshire stubbornness. You can always tell a Yorkshireman, the saying goes, but you can't tell him out.
Well, I mean, it's similar to in Cumbria, where I go pretty often because I've got a good friend who lives there, and I go there a lot. You know, they've had so many issues with flooding over the last few years, probably around the same times that those areas, you know, Hebden Bridge, whatever, is flooded. You know, Cockermouth, and you know, loads of areas in Cumbria have suffered catastrophic flooding multiple times in the last couple of decades, and probably long before as well. That when I started going up there regularly, I suppose, you know, when you live somewhere where you're not confronted with that on a daily basis, you know, I'm lucky that I live in a place that is not affected by flooding. I mean, Oxford has been flooded. It's been flooded a couple of times in the last 10 years, but not the area that I live. You know, I've never had to worry about flood defences. It's just not something that has to like register in my brain particularly. But suddenly you've got people who do have to think about this and do have to watch the rainfall and the rain levels and the river levels. And, you know, is the government putting enough into flood defences, and why are they delayed, and all of this stuff that, you know, it's that sort of having to reckon and with the natural world in a way that lots of people don't. And it just depends where you live. It ends up just being, lottery is not the right word, but it you know, some places you don't have to think about it, and some places you have to think about it every single day.
Well, some of this as well, I mean, Ben doesn't talk about it as much in the book, but there are other people who've done quite a lot on this, that part of what's happening, especially around Hebden Bridge, Mytham Royd, those sorts of areas, is because, and it happens up here, so Sheffield floods sometimes, and I think has flooded two or three times in the last sort of decade. I'm like, we're on loads of hills, so I'm on there, and which makes it worse, so I'm part way up the hill, so it's and I live in a first floor flat, it's not going to affect me. But what's happening higher up on the moor is that they are clearing it for grouse shooting, and that's what's happening outside Hebden. And so there's no, they're not doing anything about the fact that that's happening, and it's stopping. It's not, so there's no defence for the water. It's not being stopped on the way down, whereas
normally
you put some of it up.
And it disrupts the very earth. You know, there's nothing, you know, there's no roots binding things together, or, you know, it's such a, in this, in a similar way, I guess, that so much of the, stuff that he talks about with Scout Rock, with the asbestos, with it being turned into a rubbish tip, this is all humans being careless and thinking of short-term solutions for things that have such catastrophic impact in the much longer term, which is something, you know, it's a huge thing. We'll come back to talking about that in the High House. It's exactly what that novel's about, really. There's no thought to the land. And actually, something else, just talking about Cumbria again, but something that the last time I was up in Cumbria a couple of months ago, something my friend said to me, we were in Keswick, we were up with some standing stones, extraordinary, these standing stones just outside Keswick. And it's the, and it's, you know, bearing in mind, I've lived in towns and cities my whole life, I've never lived rurally, you know, I just never have. I'm always surrounded by the sound of traffic. I think it's weird when it's quiet, frankly. But the utter silence, being up there and sort of looking out onto this really extraordinary, dramatic scenery. And she said to me, you know, people always say that they talk about industrial landscape, but actually this is an industrial landscape. It might not be industrial in the way of chimneys and factories and what we think of as industry, but this is working land. This is not, you know, this is not there just to be a postcard. This is not just sort of peacefully existing. You know, this is tough scenery. This is tough land. and it's working land and it's industrial land. It's just a different sort of industry. And that came to me a bit when I was reading this. It's not quite the same, but it's that sort of idea of, we have this idea of the natural world as this kind of bucolic, beautiful, healing place. And it's not to say that it can't be those things. And he talks about in the book, you know, there's, I'm just going to find my notes from it and actually just read what Ben, like I've met him, I just call him Ben now. Hi, Ben. He says, recent years have seen our bookshop swell with works that consider the rural landscapes of Britain. Often their authors are people like me, blindly staggering around trying to make sense of the world and their place in it. I am acutely aware of the privilege of being able to do so and forever grateful. But so many of these accounts veer towards the romantic. They are escapist representations, bucolic woodcut renderings of a modern rural world, one step removed from the reality. Beautifully written, but over-precious. Few seem prepared to tackle the more insidious side of the landscape, the blood and guts of it, and also the actions of those individuals whose negative influence can define a place for decades or centuries. That idea, I thought that's actually what I loved about this book, as well as talking about the people. You know, I think it was really nice or really refreshing to read someone write about the natural world in such an unsentimental way, but yet still a kind of deeply loving way. You know, he obviously is really connected to this place. He's connected to the rock. He's connected to the place in which he lives. But for all of that, he writes about it in such a clear-eyed way that it made it, I loved it. That's really what drew me to it, really.
I think as well, it's partly because, I mean, Scout Rock's huge and dominating, and he talks about Ted Hughes and how, as a kid, like, he seems to have found it quite frightening in the way that he writes about it as an adult. But also, like, when he's off down some random path trying to find his own way in that bit that I read earlier, and I think that's it. He's not taking those tracks. There's a bit of that, I think, in the Peak District, and he mentions the Peak District when he's talking about the Millstone Grit, because obviously it was, like, the rocks that are up there have been there for, like, thousands of years, which is quite extraordinary. But also, that one of the things that always, like, winds me up about people in the Peak District is the Peak District was used to mine the rock for ages. There were factories there, and then they went. And that's why loads of the millstones are still up there. And people like to complain. So if you're up on Stannage Edge, which is one of my favourite places, you can see the cement factory that exists at the opposite side, right? And people moan about the cement factory and why it's there. The cement factory was there before they were allowed to walk through the damn place. Like, get a grip, it was there before you were.
Yeah, completely. I just wanted to read one bit that I just found very funny, and it's going back to talking about the people, and it's unconnected to any of this, but I just wanted to read it.
Okay.
When he's talking about, and I can't remember the guy's name, because as I said, I had to give my book back to the library, but this guy, he knows in the area. He also explains how in the particularly harsh winter of 2010, he and two female friends dug through a foot of ice in air temperatures of minus 15 degrees Celsius to create a narrow channel in order to enjoy a bit of private lane swimming. It's the best time for a swimmer's winter, he says. The only problem was, when I got home, I couldn't feel my hands for 3 months. Another time I was up here in the winter just as it was getting dark, and as I emerged from the ice water naked, clutching my claw hammer, right as this woman came walking by, I think she saw the funny side.
I believe it's called Keith. He props Keith up a few times. Yeah, he's very Keith,
that sounds familiar. Also, just to mention an excellent pun, where he says, he's obviously writing about, you know, messages we take from the landscape. These are missives from the mulch, if you will, postcards from the hedge. And I just wanted to acknowledge postcards from the hedge as an excellent pun.
The other thing that I just wanted to mention, because when you were talking about there about the landscape and what it creates, there's a bit towards the end, and this reminded me of, along with, so there's a bit when the bikers turn up to help, because during the flooding people start looting because they're morons, and a load of bikers turn up just to patrol the area to see who's about, and that's all they've come for. And that, and this discussion about to what extent does a place dictate behavior reminded me of We Go Around in the Night and Consumed by Fire, which I think we read last series.
Yeah.
Series with the lesbian biker gang, which
yeah,
we read.
Yeah, loved that book.
But yeah, so he talks about the people who come from what him and Adele term the Crag Hepton fax axis of evil. So there's Peter Sutcliffe, Brady and Hindley, obviously, Jimmy Savile, Harold Shipman gets a bit of a look in. And so, yeah, there's that discussion as well about whether that sort of landscape, and I think he mentions it in the book at one point, Hebden Bridge was dubbed by the national media, I have to say, the like suicide capital of the UK. And there are bits of it that are quite depressing because you're in the valley and there's these massive, like, it's quite looming sort of hills and rocks that, and it's like when I go through to in the Peak District, there's a place called Stony Middleton, and that has this sort of massive cliff face, and it's too close. You know, you're just like, I wouldn't want to live there. It feels like it's sort of looming over the top of you. So yeah, it is kind of interesting as to whether that, and the moors where, well, people are always telling me that moors are bleak anyway. I quite like moors. But the Moors and Saddleworth, where Brady and Hindley buried the bodies of the kids, are like they're high up and, you know, quite stark. So yeah, there is that sort of like, yeah. And I suppose this, it goes back into that conversation about, because I was about to say Tories when we were talking about who's getting rid of all, who's not doing anything about the fact there's grouse shooting Tories, because it's Tories that go grouse shooting. But it's that, it's back to that thing again, isn't it, about it's all linked together with structural stuff and who gets money and who's, you know, who's allowed to live a certain type of life and who can afford to live where. And
well, if central London was getting flooded every 2 years, the flood defences would go up pretty quick.
I suspect they'd be all moving out to live somewhere else. they'd designate another capital and they'd all shift there.
Yeah.
Yeah, same old, same old.
'Twas ever thus. But, I mean, I'm really glad you selected this book, actually, because it's, I don't think it's a book I would have picked up on my own. I think I needed someone like this to make me read it, and I'm really glad I did. So thanks for that.
It's all right. And we got through it all without saying my them roid once.
No, you said it earlier.
Oh, did I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He does explain in the book how to pronounce it. He because does. Obviously looking at it written down, until I got to that bit, I was just in my head, mythomroid or mytholmroid or whatever. And he does say in the book that it's my them roid.
Yeah. Todmorden as well. Which
Todmorden. Yes, I didn't know that, and I hadn't held my hands up. I didn't know that was how you pronounced it. I'd seen Todmorden written down.
Yeah, and also he didn't say it in the book, but nobody who knows it ever calls it Todmorden. Everyone calls it Todd.
Oh, really?
Which you'd only know if you like.
Yeah.
About around there, you know what I mean? So
yeah, I mean, I was born in a place called Mulgai. Not born. I wasn't born there. I lived there for the first 4 years of my life. Mulgai is spelled Milngavie.
Okay.
Yeah, and Cumbria's got its share of places. Torpenna, Torpenhow.
Okay. Mind you, there's one not far from you now that's pronounced Toaster, but is spelt Towchester.
Or Bicester, Bicester.
Oh yeah.
Bicester. Yeah. Place names are weird.
Mm.
I think is what we've learned from all of this.
They come from other places. They were named by people from other places, should I say.
They were. Yeah. I love, but I do, I love place names. I find them fascinating. I love the kind of, I love the history of it. I love London place names, you know, the kind of, the where on earth did this bit come from and that bit and, you know.
See, I like the ones that amuse me, basically. I mean, I grew up in a place called Penis Town, so what can I say? I'm saying it before someone else is, because somebody will comment. Giggleswick in North Yorkshire. Love Giggleswick.
Very good.
Yeah. What's the one in, Wisbeach.
Yeah, got that wrong. I live not far now from a place, I mean, this is so Oxfordshire, Upper and Lower Slaughter.
In so where I lived in Home Firth, if you went up the hill, you went to Upper Thong, and then you could get to Lower Thong.
I mean, I am a child in many ways, and I do find this stuff very amusing.
I found someone online. I'd forgotten about this. I need to go looking for it again because it entertained me, and I was going to buy one of his signs. Actually, there is someone who's collected like as many signs as he possibly could around the country, that are just entertaining, frankly.
Yeah, I'm all for it. You got to find joy somewhere in this world.
Yep.
And silly place names is, I think, a very good one. So, moving on cheerily, let's move on to climate change and the irrevocable destruction of our planet. Jesse Greengrass, The High House. This was published by Swift Press. Oh, a couple of years ago. It was 2021. You corrected me last week. I'd said that her debut was Sight. That was her debut novel, but she had also written a collection of short stories, which I'd forgotten about until I saw the name of them, An Account of the Decline of the Great Auk, According to One Who Saw It. And of course, I remember seeing that book title because how could you forget it? I had forgotten it was written by Jesse Greengrass, and I haven't read it. And I just see from the author bio on my copy that she now lives in Berwick-upon-Tweed.
Yeah.
There you go.
Which gives a connection with Ben Myers, who is from, not from Berwick. I'm trying to remember where he's from.
Is he not from Durham area?
Yeah, he is from Durham. Well, outside County Durham. But also, yeah, clearly the book is set around that area as well, although it's never named.
Yes, absolutely. So this is a novel about so there's Caro, Paulie, who's her younger half brother, and Sally, who is, well, she know how do they, yeah, no, actually that's quite complicated to try and
A bit of
explain.
a spoiler as well to
It
say.
is a spoiler, so I'm not going to give that spoiler, but the High House refers to a house on high ground, where Caro and Paulie and Sally live in an unspecified time, most likely in the near future, where there has been massive catastrophic flooding, climate disaster has been wrought, millions and millions of people are dead, including Caro and Paulie's mother slash stepmother, Francesca, and their father. But they have got sanctuary in the High House, which has sort of become their ark in a way. They live a very sort of necessarily self-sufficient lifestyle, but living from stockpiles of goods that Francesca, who was a climate scientist, stocked for over a long period of time. Sort of knowing that essentially that this was going to happen and wanting to build a sanctuary for her child and stepchild to go and live, even though she herself would not survive to see it. That's the basic thrust of the book. It goes backwards and forwards in time of before this climate disaster and now, whenever now is. Of the day-to-day living, and eventually you see sort of what happened when the disaster actually occurred, and so on and so forth. I loved Sight, and I loved this book. I thought it was incredibly well written. I love her writing anyway. There were some really harrowing scenes, where sort of awful stuff happened. They're just sort of what she's really good at, I think, is the sort of quiet day-to-day stuff around which these incredible, extraordinary events are happening. And I think she writes character incredibly well. But what did you think?
I really enjoyed it. I don't think I enjoyed it as much as Sight. I think that's partly to do with the ending, which it kind of just fades, which it sort of it fits with the book, but it felt a bit anticlimactic almost. Although it made me think about a conversation that I've had several times about what would you do if an atomic bomb was dropped, and I was like, run towards it and die is what I would do. And it reminded, like, well, because I don't want to fucking survive that, thanks. And the fact that she's built this house that the kids are now sort of stuck in, I mean, they're not kids by this point, they're adults, but they're stuck there basically waiting to die. I'm like, fuck that, I'd be down in the village, like, getting drowned, we're all good, I'm done. So yeah, I guess it made me think a lot, and I do love her writing. I think until the end I really enjoyed it. I suppose it's that it felt a bit anticlimactic, but maybe the end for humans is going to be anticlimactic.
Yeah, I mean that's, I think, the central question of it is, you know, Caro spends so much of her childhood thinking that Francesca, who's her stepmother, is unbothered by her. She, you know, she's a climate scientist. She keeps them sort of going off and leaving Paulie, who is the very young child of Francesca and their dad. You know, so that Caro essentially raises him. Caro's his sort of primary person. And Caro's angry about that. And you can see why she's angry about that, because she feels that, you know, she's a teenager at this point, and she's been sort of lumbered with this small child who she adores. That's not lumbered as in she doesn't love him. She adores him and cares for him incredibly. But, you know, she's not had the option of kind of, as she sees it, going off and having her own life. She's been left to bring up the baby, essentially, while her parents, dad and stepmom, go off, you know, dealing with climate change as she sees it. Of course, what is revealed is that, as you go on, is that actually what Francesca's also done is created this high house, this the house that they owned up on high ground. She has, you know, set up the land around it so that it can be self-sufficient. She has stocked a barn with multiple sizes of clothing, with Lego sets, with stockpiles of food, of everything they could possibly need, basically, and has done that so that her children can live. And it's clearly, I think, meant as this kind of profound act of love and parenting, and you know, I can't change the world, but I can change this bit for you. You know, I will keep you safe, even if it looks like I'm abandoning you, I am keeping you safe. But of course, actually, as you just said, is that the kindest thing to do? You can see her motivation for doing it, but actually she's ultimately sort of doomed them to this sort of very protracted lifelong. I mean, they're getting along quite fine, you know. Yes, they have to be very careful and they've got limited provisions, but essentially they've been living there for decades sort of without incident. But there's going to come a point where they're just going to die, and so has she done them a kindness or not? And I think that's a really interesting question.
Well, I found her the most interesting character by far, which I'll talk about a bit more in a minute, in relation to Monsters by Claire Dederer, which I've also been reading this week. But the stuff about the kids, I think what I found most interesting about it was, ultimately, she had raised them to be selfish, because there's a point where they could help and they go, oh, no, we haven't got enough supplies, if we take people in, then that's that. So they doom the people in the village, like, you know, because they're protected. And it was very much like, it was like she'd set up this class system that it felt like she'd used her privilege to go out into the world and say, look, this is what's happening. She'd toured the world doing, like, which is a contradiction in itself. That made me laugh. She's toured the world, so she's added to climate change by going around the world talking about climate change, which is clearly what people are doing at the minute, unless you're Greta Thunberg and you're spending weeks in a ship or whatever. But there was this inherent selfishness in it. And also it felt like she didn't know. Really interesting that she wanted to save. And when we talk about Sorry, I'm off on one a bit, because when we talk about saving the world, what we're actually talking about is saving humanity. We're not talking about saving the planet. Because actually, and Ben talks about this at the end of Under the Rock, where he talks about rewilding and says it's just like another fucking project where people are getting involved. And actually, the real rewinding is that humans disappear and the planet gets to live, like, you know, as it should, because what's doing the damage to the planet is us. We're a parasite. Ben doesn't use that word, but I just we're a parasite on the planet. So. I've lost my point now about what I was saying about her. But she goes around, she goes around talking about this, like trying to save humanity or whatever. And ultimately dies for the cause. I'll not give too much away, but she literally, that's it's almost like this mad act of, well, everyone's gonna watch if I'm in this place when this thing happens. It felt a bit like influencer culture. I know she's an academic, but it did feel a bit like this is where it ends in terms of so that was selfish. And so I felt like for her as a person, she had this like sort of desire to have, there was some sort of nurturing instinct where she wanted to like save people generally, but she couldn't do that for her kids, for the people closest to her. It was like that bit of vulnerability was missing. And interestingly, as someone who I suspect would rail against capitalism, what she does is the most capitalist thing possible. She buys all this shit and stocks it up. So yeah, I found it interesting because she was so contradictory, her behavior so contradictory. And I suppose it's that thing in it, we're back to personal versus political, like,
yeah,
what, where do you sit on that? I mean, it's a spectrum in it. Where do you sit on it? And the answer is probably in many different places at many different times.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because if I think about it now with my kids, if I were in that position, of course I'd go out my way to try and save them, because that's just, it's inherently the instinct, isn't it? But that's the longer term thing that you're not looking at or can't confront. You know, I don't think we could confront it. It's sort of too horrific to countenance. There are so many contradictions all happening at once. And I think testament to the skill of Jesse Greengrass as a writer is she manages to convey all of that in relatively few words. Like, her writing is quite spare in places. She says a lot with very little. And does it really well.
Yeah, and on that like note about the contradiction, so this is right near the beginning, and one of the things that I was taught on my master's, thank you Ian Sonson, was that a writer sets out their stall very early on in the book. There's a conversation between Francesca and I think it must be Caro talking about this at this point. Yeah, it is. So this is only a few pages into the book. And they're at the High House, and people have been up for holiday lets, so they're hanging out, like, having picnics, they're on the beach, la, la, la. And Francesca back in the house would say, how can they stand to enjoy it this weather? She didn't have the habit that the rest of us were learning of having our minds in two places at once, being two futures. That ordinary one of summer holidays and new school terms, of Christmases and birthdays and bank accounts in an endless, uneventful round. And the other one, the long and empty one we spoke about in hypotheticals or didn't speak about at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And she says as well, there's a line, I'm just trying to find it. Oh yeah, things happen slowly and then all at once. And that so reminded me of the sort of run up to the pandemic starting, you know, that sort of, we were seeing the news reports come out of China and Italy and various other places, and oh God, isn't that awful, that terrible virus that's, you know, but until it did start to happen here, it was very easy just to go about your business and just act like everything was normal. And with the benefit of hindsight, of course, you look back and go, my God, especially those kind of, say, the first couple of weeks in March, where before everything started to lock down, but when the news reports were starting to look a bit grim. And I remember, actually, I had a launch party in the first week of March. And we were all kind of half joking, oh, do we do an elbow bump? Ha, ha, ha. you know, are you still hugging? Oh, let's hug, it'll be fine. And of course, not 2 weeks later, we're all sitting in our homes, working from home, the schools are shut. You know, suddenly it was there and it happened. And it was this sort of entirely new reality that none of us have had to confront before. And so reading this book and that sort of, again, the news reports, the things happening in far off places, or the summers are just a little bit hotter, or, you know, the swallows aren't back at the right time or leaving at the right time. And, you know, all of those things, again, that, like we were saying just now with the asbestos thing, that happen gradually and over time and a long way away, and they gradually creep closer. It's very easy just to sort of carry on going to Tesco and doing your shopping and putting the bins out until one day you're all underwater.
Yeah, well, there's a line in there that, like, hang on, where are we? Not towards the end. I'm trying to look. About 100 pages in, where Sally is talking about how she sees Francesca as this fierce and angry academic, but Francesca talks about what we're going to do because the government will intervene. And when you're talking about, like, joking about elbow bumps and all that, that's because we had a prime minister who was on the news fucking joking about it and then caught COVID and ended up in hospital. So,
yeah.
Like, it's the relationship that we're living under, isn't it? Anyway, I'll not go on a political rant again.
Well, that's exactly the point, isn't it? It's, you know, there are people screaming about climate change, climate disasters, you know, more now than ever, but it's still very easy. It's still very easy just to carry on. Mm-hmm. You know, I say that probably as guilty as anyone. I try and do my bit, but do I think about it every day? Probably not, and probably I should.
That's also one of the points in the book, isn't it, about how there's only so much you can do as an individual. In fact,
exactly.
I was reading something earlier about that, about the, yeah. Oh, it's in Claire Dedera's book. She also talks about it, and about how, yeah, you can do all these things, but actually it's systemic, and lots of what she's talking about is systemic. And I do want to talk about this because, so her book came from an article that she wrote a couple of years ago, I think, called What Do We Do With the Art of Monstrous Men, which went viral, which, if I remember correctly, was about Woody Allen. I can't remember whether it was about Woody Allen or Roman Polanski, because in my head, they're like,
the same.
I put them in the same bin, basically. Anyway, so she's written this book all about it, which is fucking brilliant. She tackles, like, the women as well. So what do we do with these women who were horrendous? And what she says is the difference between the two is, like, she puts it this bluntly, and it's a little bit flippant, but, like, deliberately so. Men are rapists. Women abandon their children. and she talks about, and that's it, if you're not nurturing as a woman, then you're horrendous, you know, you're a terrible person. And she talks about Doris Lessing, who abandoned two of her children, bought the youngest, weirdly also called Paul. I don't know whether that's a, like, comparison with this as well. We know that Doris Lessing was quite a fierce academic as well. So she brought her youngest with her back to England when she walked out on her marriage and her other two children. And there's a whole bit as well with Jenny Diskey, who lived with her for a while because she sort of adopted her as almost an adult. And Diskey has spoken about how difficult she was to live with and what have you, as if, like, she was trying to make up for what she'd done. But anyway, so this is what I found interesting about Francesca, is because she essentially abandons them to go around the world and talk about climate change, is what she does. And particularly, I mean, at that point, Caro is, like you said, she's the late teens, which is no better, but she's not tiny. And then there's Paul, who is quite small, Paulie, and doesn't remember much about her at all, really, when he gets older. So I was really interested in that as this conversation about women and motherhood, which I think we've been having for quite a long time now. You know, people who do that, who walk out on the kids, like, I don't know where I'm going with this. I just found it fascinating. And don't think, well, I mean, she doesn't have an answer, does she? Like, we talked about, she leaves all that. I mean, Greengrass doesn't have an answer. She has a leave all that stuff, and she builds this almost fortress for the kids. But it's almost as if, like, they're untouchable to her as well. She's put on a pedestal, and she can't. And there's a bit where it's clear that she's jealous of Caro because she spends that much time with Paulie, that he wants Caro to read to him, and he's working with her, and she gets annoyed about it in a sort of very quiet, stealth, like,
yeah,
but still is irritated by it. So yeah, I just found all that fascinating. I thought that was quite a brave thing to write about. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I think brave. I think probably because backlash and that thing about collating authors with what they're writing about, which is clearly not the case. But
yeah. No, absolutely. Well, it is a difficult subject. It is, you know, mothers abandoning their children is still a kind of massive taboo. It's the kind of thing, you know, I've always been a very maternal and maternally driven. I was one of those people, you know, I knew when I was 12 that I wanted to have kids. Like, it's always been a really important goal of mine was to have children. The idea of abandoning my children makes me feel physically sick. I can't imagine how anyone could do it. That's not how I'm built. But I think it's really interesting to look at those questions of people that do and why, you know, and sort of expectations of women, expectations of motherhood, expectations of what motherhood looks like. I'm really interested in ideas of what family is, you know, and what family does and how family functions. I think family is incredibly important, but I don't think it has to look like mum, dad and 2.4 children. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that fascinating, and sort of those sort of built communities, however you build those communities. Yeah, I don't know where I'm going with that either, other than to say, yes, I agree with you. I think they're all really, really fascinating questions.
Yeah, I think from the way you were talking about it, I almost wanted, and this is not, you couldn't fit it in the book, but I'm like, what was her mother like? Is my next, because it's that in it. I suspect, I mean, there's no backstory to her, we don't know, but I suspect there's like, that's been passed on in some way. Like, because we've talked about this before, we talked about it when we did Heidi James's book, that I never wanted kids, and that is very much to do with the way that I was raised. So, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, all fascinating.
It is. Two very good books with lots of stuff to talk about. So next week is Crime Week, which we have every series, which I'm very much looking forward to. We are going to be reading In the Woods by Tana French, which is that her first novel? It's certainly the first in the Dublin.
I think it was her first altogether, yeah.
I'm really looking forward to.
Well, I'm interested to read it because I've read... I can't remember if it's one or two of her later ones, which, and I know people rave about her, and I did not love.
So,
I read The Windmill, I think it was.
So, funnily enough, I had this conversation with some colleagues recently. I have not read The Witch Elm, but I can think of at least two people I know who have read The Witch Elm, and it's the only book by Tana French they've read, and they've gone, don't get the fuss, I don't understand why.
It's not easy.
No, very much not just you. Whereas I have read Broken Harbour, which is the fourth book in her Dublin series. And when I bought it, I didn't realise it was in a series, but I read it anyway. And I thought that was excellent. So I'm really looking forward to this because I'm hoping The Witch Elm might be just a dip.
It's about a privileged dickhead and I didn't care.
No, fair. So we'll see what we think of that next week. And the other one is Furious Hours by Casey Sepp, which is a sort of true crime, but with a bit of Harper Lee.
Committing the crimes.
Yes, or solving.
Back from the dead.
Back from the dead to do crime. That's not what it's, no. But it's a case that she was writing about, I believe. I don't know because I've not read the book yet. but there we go. So, yeah, that's what we're doing next week.
So, in the meantime, you can subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. And is that all I need to say? I think so.
Yeah.
Yes. Otherwise, we will see you next week. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.